Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Mark Smith, President and Chief Executive Officer of the California Healthcare Foundation, which is the underwriter for tonight's program. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, Chair of the Department of Bioethics at the Clinical Center of the National Institutes of Health, and author of a new book called Healthcare Guaranteed. I'm not going to belabor my introduction of Dr. Emanuel. He is known to many of you in many ways, but I can't let the opportunity go unnoticed that he wrote what is, in my view, one of the most insightful articles written in the last several years, in which he pointed out that today's generation of physicians in the 21st century, rather than being required to take psychology, is required to take physics. Rather than taking organizational behavior, is taking organic chemistry. And rather than taking communications, is taking calculus. It's one example of the extraordinarily insightful contributions that Dr. Emanuel has made, and making it, as he does, from the pinnacle of what is arguably the world's most prestigious and influential biomedical research enterprise makes him all the more remarkable. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Zeke Emanuel.
Well, for anyone who tries to educate the public, it is a tremendous pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club. It's one of those pinnacle places that you dream about being able to speak at, and it's really my privilege. And I am amazed, I was told, I'm not a football fan, that there is a big football game tonight, and I'm amazed that so many people turned out despite missing the football game tonight. One of the things that Mark Smith didn't say about me is that I do a lot of serving. I do a lot of serving of doctors, a lot of serving of patients and the public about various medical issues. And I want to start tonight's talk by a little bit of a survey. I'm going to begin with two questions. The first question is, overall, how well do you think the healthcare system is functioning today? How many people think it's functioning very well? Hold up your hands. There's one person I see. Moderately well, a few more, fairly well. That seems to be the majority of people. Not well at all, and there's a sizable number there too. So my second question for you is, overall, how happy are you personally with the healthcare services that you personally get? Very happy. About half the audience. Moderately happy. Another good chunk, fairly happy, not happy at all. That shift, the fact that a large number of you find the system not operating very well, but a large number of you also are personally very happy, is one of the big barriers to healthcare reform, and we're going to come back to that at the end of the talk. Political scientists who study American politics note that there are four things that have to coalesce and come together if we're going to get big change in American society. First, you have to have widespread recognition that there's a problem with the American healthcare or the American system, whatever that problem is. Second, you need an agreed-upon solution by the major actors. Third, you need a champion or a set of champions who are going to push that through thick and thin, the ups and downs of the system. And last, you need a transforming political event that'll open the policy window through which you can pass legislation. So it's useful to ask about those four questions, how they relate to the healthcare system that we have and our moment today in 2009. First, the problem. I do think overall we could say that the problems of the American healthcare system are pretty well recognized. We could go down a laundry list and I could spend all night, and tomorrow morning we could adjourn just talking about the problems. But let's talk about three in particular, the big three, the coverage problem. All of us have been beaten over the head over and over, about 47 million people uninsured, and you can bet with the recession and the depression that we are about to continue to endure, it's going to go up. What you probably know less well is the fact that between two-thirds and 75% of those uninsured are either full-time working people or in the households of full-time working people. Now, that is very un-American. They work hard, and yet they're not getting the benefits of American society. More heartbreaking is the fact that 9 million of the uninsured are children, and we can't possibly expect them to pay for their own health care coverage. Then there's the cost problem. We spend $2.2 trillion on health care each year. Now, you are a very smart audience, and I've been to a lot of smart places, Harvard, Washington University, University of Michigan Medical School, University of Virginia Law School, lots of places. And what I learn is that very few Americans have a good sense for trillion. So I'm going to give you a sense of how big a trillion is. How long ago was a million seconds? Anyone know? It's last week. It's about 11 days ago. A billion seconds ago? Round about when Richard Nixon resigned the White House. A trillion seconds ago? 30,000 BC. That's 15,000 years before any human being stepped foot in the North American continent, and we're spending two of those each year. Just an astounding number. You can't even get your head around it. You know, we're talking and we're worried about China and the Chinese economy and the fact that they might overtake the United States as the next superpower. We spend on healthcare almost the entire Chinese GDP. We spend it on healthcare alone. Their GDP is about $2.5 trillion. We're spending $2.2 trillion on healthcare. And it's not just how much we're spending, it's how much it's growing year to year. Since 2000, healthcare premiums on insurance have gone up 75%, double inflation. As a matter of fact, if you graph out where healthcare spending is going, I call it the tsunami graph if you look at it, because it goes up, and by 2082, we're either all patients or all doctors, and that's it. The entire economy is healthcare. We have to get that under control. It's taking money away from everything else we care about, whether it's education or it's travel or it's our infrastructure. And then there's the quality of the care we're actually buying. Yes, we have some peaks of tremendous quality in this country, whether it's right here in San Francisco at UCSF or Stanford, Mayo Clinic, Harvard. But we also know that the quality is uneven, unpredictable. And lots of studies have shown that your chance of getting the right medicine is roughly the flip of a coin. Not very good. We have a high use of unproven treatments that cost a lot of money and don't add a lot. And we have a very fragmented system. The average Medicare beneficiary sees seven different doctors in a year, including five specialists, and they're unconnected. They're not related clinically. They're not related administratively. No shared electronic medical records. This is no way to run a system. Most Americans, even if they don't know the details that I've mentioned here, understand that the system's broken. The way you voted suggested that you understand that the system isn't working. So we understand that we have a problem in this country, and I think it's very widespread. Prior to the economy cratering, healthcare was either the top or the second top issue in the presidential election. The second thing we need is shared agreement on reforms. Now, there are lots of proposals for reforming the healthcare system in this country. Lots and lots of proposals, maybe hundreds of them. But they can all be boiled down to one of four flavors. You either are an incrementalist, we're going to make some changes, we're not going to try to achieve any of the big items all at once, we're not going to try to get universal coverage and cost control and quality, we're going to have electronic medical records, or we're going to try to expand SCHIP, or we're going to try to do a few things around the edges. Personally, I'm not sure why this is very persuasive to people if you think the system is broken, because doing a few things around the edges is not going to fundamentally fix what we need fixed. You do that only if you can't get big reform. That's a compromise position. That's not the position you go in at the start. That's not the end state. As a matter of fact, most people who advocate incremental reform advocate it as politically feasible, not as the best policy option. But we should be thinking about the best policy option, not what we can do, because we're often wrong about what we can actually achieve. The second possible reform are mandates. Now, you in California have been very experienced with this. Your debate in the last year was about having an individual mandate and employer mandates to try to get to 100% coverage, try to facilitate people buying insurance by establishing insurance exchanges so that they can get the product cheaper, and then subsidizing people who are poor to buy those products. Massachusetts has tried that, and it's had some very important successes. I was just talking to the guy who runs their connector, their insurance exchange, and their rate of uninsurance about 2.5 years after implementation is down to 2.6 or 2.7% from 10%. That is a big improvement. That is a very big improvement. And satisfaction with the system is very high, and political support is very high. They haven't done anything about cost control, and there are a lot of people and commentators who are worried that rising costs will undermine the system. Then they're single payer. A lot of people have proposed that we have Medicare for all or a Canadian-style single-payer system. I myself do not think that's the best system. It's very hard to provide a single-payer system for 300 million Americans. There's never been one organizational structure that's provided any service to 300 million people anywhere in the world. There are other difficulties, in my opinion. I'll mention two of them. One of the problems of most single-payer proposals is they lock in the fee-for-service delivery system, where they pay doctors to do more and more. That is not a very good system for improving the quality of care, for creating more organized and coordinated care. And second, as we've seen with Medicare, it's very difficult to have effective cost control under these systems because of political pressure. The last set of proposals doesn't have a very elegant name. I've now begun calling it social insurance that's unrelated or delinked from the employment system. It's actually the proposal I want to elaborate for you. The proposal that Victor Fuchs, who's a professor of health economics at Stanford, and I like to refer to him as one of the original three horsemen. He's one of the original three economists to look at the healthcare system way back in the 50s and 60s. He and I have been working for 5 years on what we call the Guaranteed Healthcare Access Plan. And it's got 10 elements to it. And I'll just go through the 10 elements for you. First, people get a voucher to buy a standard benefits package, which is modeled on what congressmen and senators get, the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan. Insurance companies have to guarantee issues, so if you come with the certificate, they have to give you insurance, they have to renew the insurance, and there are no pre-existing disease exclusions. In exchange for that, everyone's in the system. Everybody gets in the system. Individual Americans have a choice between 5 and 8 plans, and they can choose which one fits with them better, which combination of doctors and hospitals, which set of co-pays is better for them. Third, the plan's funded by a value-added tax dedicated to healthcare. That means that the tax only goes to healthcare and we don't add any other money. And it doesn't get diverted to Social Security, wars in Iraq, or whatever. Fourth, Americans have the option of buying additional services, supplementary insurance. They want a wider selection of doctors and hospitals. You want concierge medicine, you can buy it in addition. Five, the private sector continues to organize and deliver care, creates the networks, provides the services, figures out how to pay doctors and hospitals. Six, the tax exclusion for employment-based coverage is phased out. What does that mean? Those of you who get insurance through your employer, you don't pay income tax and you don't pay payroll tax on that. That is the single biggest tax deduction in the United States income tax code. It's worth more than $220 billion, twice as much as the mortgage deduction. And it's incredibly regressive. The rich get more because they have typically better health insurance and are in a higher tax bracket. And if you have to pay for insurance out of your own pocket, you get none of that benefit. So our proposal is to get rid of it and to decrease the incentive for employment-based coverage. Seventh, we would phase out Medicare and Medicaid. That doesn't mean anyone would be thrown off, just no new enrollees. So if people turn 65, they stay with the Guaranteed Health Care Access Plan. Eight, administration of the system, these insurance exchanges, deciding what's in the benefits package, assessing the quality of plans, done by an independent health board modeled on the Federal Reserve System. So people are appointed for a long time. They have separate funding mechanism through the value-added tax. Ninth, there would be an Institute for Technology and Outcomes Assessment. And what that would do is two things. First, it would take new technologies and evaluate them, whether existing data on research or conduct and undertake new studies to compare existing technologies to new technologies. It would also do what's called outcomes assessment, which is to evaluate processes of care, combinations of care, because not everyone gets an individual technology. You often have people getting multiple technologies, and there's other things that aren't just technologies that need to be evaluated. How often should we actually have you see the doctor? How often do these follow-on tests matter? Finally, we would have malpractice reform and patient safety through centers of patient safety and dispute resolution. Patients who think they've been injured would file with these centers, and those who have been determined to be injured would be compensated. But more importantly, you'd have an organization responsible for patient safety with the responsibility, accountability, and resources to actually implement proven patient safety measures. Right now, we have no such organization. Now, I think this plan is where we want to end up. We are not going to get there by flipping a switch tomorrow and being there. But I think it's where we want to end up. It's the best policy option. Many people who've looked at it, including people who don't advocate it, think it's the best policy option, and they typically don't advocate it, not because it isn't right, but because they think it's too hard to get to. Those are the four alternatives. Let me recap them. Incremental reform mandates what they're doing in Massachusetts, single payer, and then something like our Guaranteed Health Care Access Plan. The third element you need recognition of a problem, you need agreed upon solution, is you need a champion or a set of champions who are going to champion a proposal through thick and thin. We have a lot of champions, but I think that there are some key groups who have not weighed in the current situation. Let me mention a few of them. One of them are businesses. Now, a lot of businesses and chief executive officers have complained about the healthcare system, complained about the cost of the healthcare system, and said we have to change. But what you haven't heard enough of, it seems to me, is what are they for? We know that they don't like the current system, but if we're going to get out of here, out of the problem, we need them to say what will they accept, what is acceptable to them. And they have to lead and not just wait. A second group are governors. I've not quite understood why governors are not more active in this. Right now, Medicaid and the increasing costs of providing coverage, and certainly in the recession that we're in with more people who are going to be uninsured and unemployed, Medicaid is simply handcuffing governors from doing new things. Right now, in most states, Medicaid, SCHIP, and insurance for state workers consumes a third of the state budget. Healthcare is the number one item on state budgets. And because it goes up faster than tax receipts, it's consuming more and more money from state budgets. So initiatives that governors would like to undertake and state legislators would like to undertake, whether it's in education or the environment or infrastructure, very hard. Finally, our patient advocates. The current system is getting very difficult for many patients. If you have a disease, some of the drugs that are necessary are enormously expensive, and the co-pays and co-insurance are very high. I know that I, as an oncologist, have begun talking to a lot of oncology groups, and they are very concerned because many of their members, they know what the right treatment is, but it's very difficult, and the costs are high, and they're also beginning to worry and begin to be clued into the issue of maybe they're not getting great quality for their illnesses. Last, I would suggest there's a very important group that has to recognize the link with healthcare, and that are the budget hawks, people who are worried about the deficit's impact on our children and our grandchildren. What's driving these deficits in state government and federal government? Healthcare. And they, I think, have to recognize that healthcare reform is critical to ending the budget deficits. The last item, if we really want reform, is a transforming political event. You can have all three. You can have a recognition of a problem. You can have agreed upon solution. You can have champions. But that won't go anywhere until something big happens that changes the landscape and allows reform to happen. Well, I think we've had a transforming political event. We've actually had two transforming political events that make reform more likely now than it has been in a long while, maybe than ever. One is the election of Barack Obama, a black president, 143 years after the end of the Civil War, who won two Confederate states, where many Americans tune into him and listen to him in a way that I haven't seen for a long time. People stop and listen to what he has to say. And he has an amazing ability to articulate what the country feels and to explain himself in a way that people, I think, really believe. And you can see the very positive feelings. The American people want him to succeed. He's also done something pretty remarkable, which I think with his appointments has made an amazing team, and I'm going to get back to that in a second. A second potential transforming event is this fiscal crisis we're in, though clearly the worst since the Great Depression. And I think it has changed the landscape in several ways. We are now talking about spending hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe even $1 trillion for recovery. Healthcare reform fits into that. Second, with the potential rise in unemployment, the financial insecurity, American population is going to want security. And one key element of that financial security is secure healthcare. They want to know that if, God forbid, they become unemployed or their employer hits financial turmoil and cuts the health insurance, they're still covered. I think they're going to really push for healthcare guarantee now. Second, there are employers. They don't want this on their books anymore. It's weighing them down. It could be the difference between staying afloat and not. Then I suggest there's also going to be these budget hawks who have understood that we need to have healthcare reform to actually reduce the budget deficit. And that if we're going to spend a lot of money in stimulus, we actually have to spend more prudently in other areas. Now, I shouldn't end. I'm going to end with two more comments. The first is we should be sober. There are, despite these transforming events, lots and lots of barriers to reform. We have failed for over 90 years in healthcare reform. Well, as I stated at the start, the vote we took here, or the poll I took here on those two questions, suggested one barrier. Most of us are happy with our own personal circumstance, even if we think the system's broken. And so the attitude, even if we don't articulate it, is, oh, yes, change the healthcare system, but keep mine, just as it is. Very hard to do that. Second, we have a political system which is given to gridlock and given not to passing major reforms. When James Madison wrote the Constitution, right, what was he worried about? Tyranny. What did he want? Checks and balances so no one could actually usurp the reins of government too much. And he succeeded. He'd be very proud of the gridlock. Makes it hard to change, though. Then there's what I like to call the Machiavelli rule of reform. Machiavelli is a great political scientist, and he was advising the prince, and he says, beware of initiating anything new, because those people who have an investment in the old system are going to oppose you vigorously, whereas those people who might benefit by the new system, only lukewarm supporters. Why? Those who are going to lose know what they're going to lose. And those who support you, well, it's a hypothetical, it's abstract, maybe it won't pass. And then there's finally what I think many of you in California have experienced, the rule of second best. Some of you may be incrementalist. Some of you may be for mandates. Some of you may be diehard single-payer advocates. Some of you I might have convinced to my program. All of us have a second best. Do nothing. I suggest to you, it's not a second best in the current system. It's a prescription for failure, but it's hard for us to know. Why am I optimistic nonetheless, despite all these things? And let me conclude on that. I do think we have a unique moment in our history, a unique recognition of the problems, a growing consensus about some of the key elements to change, even if we can't agree on the final outcome. I also think we have a unique set of characters in Washington that make this more possible. First, the president has assembled an amazing team, beginning with Senator Tom Daschle and his assistant Jeanne Lambrew to head health care reform. His director of Office of Management Budget, Peter Orszag, has studied health care and at the Congressional Budget Office issued report after report. He really understands the economic problems related to that. Larry Summers, the National Economic Coordinator, also understands health care. His most important academic paper probably is on health care. And finally, there's my brother who actually understands how to get things through. I didn't say that about him, though. In the Congress, Senator Baucus and Senator Kennedy are committed. Senator Baucus, chairman of the Finance Committee, Senator Kennedy, chairman of the Health Committee, the two key committees. They really want to get something done, and we haven't had that combination in a while. And on the House side, there are many powerful and smart people committed to health care reform. Henry Waxman, among the leaders. I think that's a unique combination of talent who really want to get something done. I think they understand the problems. They understand what's doable. And I think we do have a chance to really have a difference here and to put ourselves on the right course to changing our system so we can get full coverage of Americans at a reasonable cost and with high quality for the first time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Zeke Emanuel, for your comments here this evening. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm going to be conducting the audience question tonight, and we not only have a full house, we have a very active house here, as you can see, with quite a few questions. So let's get right to them. First of all, I would say probably half the questions that we received are in one way or another related to your criticisms of the single-payer system. Let's start with one asking you to elaborate a bit on the comment in your book that single-payer will break the bank, quote-unquote. Also tonight, I would add, you did say one of your concerns is it's very difficult to impose cost controls with single-payer. How, many ask.
How difficult?
How would it break the bank?
So let me say a few words about single-payer. The fundamental structure of single payer is that we're going to have one national plan for everyone that's going to cover a fairly robust set of services. We're going to get rid of the insurance companies and save money on the administrative costs. We're going to have a national drug formulary and save money by driving prices down continue with the fee-for-service reimbursement system that we have now. So I have a number. The way I like to think of single payer is the most radical reform on the financing of healthcare while keeping the 19th century horse and buggy delivery system that we have now. And that is not a tenable long-term strategy. So let me say a few things about that. I think one of the fundamental things we need to do in American healthcare, and one of the litmus tests you can use to evaluate healthcare reform proposals, is how do they reform the financing system to get everyone in, but also how do they reform the delivery system to make sure that we control costs and we improve the quality of care. And one of my major problems with single-payer systems is they keep the old payment system of fee-for-service, and they do not, therefore, encourage quality of care. Fee-for-service encourages doctors to do more things, more tests, more procedures, not necessarily paying them better for quality. If you want quality, I think if you study around the world and you study the best systems in the United States, whether it's Mayo or Gelsing or the Cleveland Clinic, what you see is that they have coordinated care. They coordinate the doctors with the hospitals, with the home health care agencies, with the pharmacies, with the nursing homes. That can't be done on a fee-for-service basis. As a matter of fact, fee-for-service militates exactly against that. And so it seems to me one of the fundamental things you need is payment reform, and at least the major proposals on single-payer don't go there. And, in fact, I would say that the political structure of just having one payer makes it very hard to change the payment system. Second, I don't know the best way to pay doctors, the best way to pay hospitals. I don't think anyone in the world does. We know the worst. That's what we're doing. But we don't know the best. And therefore, we need a lot of innovation and experiments. And we just haven't had that. Finally, on the cost control issue, single-payer proposals mainly suggest that they're going to have cost control. They're going to have cost savings immediately by reducing the administrative costs. They're going to have cost control over time, change how much we're spending. They have one mechanism, and that's reduce the price they pay to doctors, reduce the price they pay to the pharmaceutical industry, reduce the price you pay to hospitals and all the other providers. Well, you don't have to be a PhD in economics to know that that is generally a failed cost control mechanism. Setting prices has lots of ways of getting around it. One way is you can increase the number of things you do. And so you just collect the same amount of money or more. Another is you invent something new that doesn't have a price yet and you get a higher price for it. And that happens with a lot of technological innovation in medicine. It is not an effective way of setting and trying to control costs. The final thing I would say is one I mentioned before in passing, which is the issue of scale. It is very hard to imagine running a healthcare system 300 million people. We don't run anything. There is no organization that big in the world. And I would challenge you to suggest that that's going to be an efficient system if you run it for 300 million people in one organization. If we think we've got bureaucracy when we've got, you know, some system that run for 30 million or 40 million people, 10 times the size. Well, you can point to Canada. Canada is one-tenth the size of the United States, excuse me. Nowhere near the complexity. I just think scaling it up is going to be not just difficult, impossible. So we're going at it again, I can see.
You didn't really think you were only going to get away with one question about single payer, did you?
I'll run out the clock.
There were a number of questions about single payer, particularly
right.
on this aspect.
Yeah.
And I'll pick the one that only took one side of a card. And that is, why would we even include the insurance industry in a national health care plan when their fundamental role has been to avoid the sick, deny claims, and pass costs on to others?
So let's agree with the second half of that. That is what they have been doing, and that is how they make money. Absolutely. And here's the question for you. Do you think every year those insurance companies go to the best business schools in the country, whether it's Stanford or MIT and Harvard, and say, give us your nastiest, meanest graduates so we can make them insurance executives? Or do you think it's a different situation, which is, they are in a very bad situation where the incentive structure that they're given by the way we structure the healthcare system is to do exactly that. I suggest to you, it's the second. We have created an environment and a structure where that is their response so that they can make money, which is what they have to do. We have created the behavior we don't want. So you can either say, get rid of them, and I'll tell you why I don't think that's such a hot idea, or you can say, we really have to change the incentive structure here to do something different. Why don't we want to get rid of them? They have behaved badly. We all agree to that. And believe me, when I have to fight about my claims, I absolutely share that. But we need an organization which is going to provide information systems, is going to provide an infrastructure to bring doctors and hospitals and home health care agencies and all the other providers together, and is going to provide incentives for them to work together. You can call it whatever you want, a coordinator, an integrator. It's going to look a lot like an insurance company in the end. Because you have to have an organization that does that kind of stuff. The question is, can we change the incentive structure for them so that they do the right thing? So let me give you some suggestions about that. One is a standard benefits package so that they're not competing on taking services out. Two, risk-adjusted payment. That's a fancy word, but here's what it means. You pay them more for taking care of sick people with diabetes or heart failure or emphysema or asthma, and less to take care of healthy 20-year-olds. Right now, they have a big incentive to get the healthy 20-year-olds. They get the premium, and they don't have a lot of payments. Change that. Pay them more to take care of sick patients, and then you're going to see a different kind of behavior. Also, have a situation where they keep you for a long time. You have an incentive to stay with them for a long time. Suddenly, their behavior is going to change. Because if they let you get sick, if they don't prevent your illnesses, it's on their tab. Well, that changes their incentive structure tremendously. Right now, things change. Your employer decides he wants a cheaper deal, switches insurance companies. Not a very good incentive for them to do the right thing. So I could be wrong, but I think, you know, psychology has this concept called the fundamental attribution error, which is we attribute to people bad behaviors, and it's really the environment, that almost all of us set in that environment would behave badly. It seems to me that's what we've got, and what we really need to do is to look into the structure of the system. It's too easy for us to point fingers and say, bad boy, when what we have is a bad system, and we've created the behavior we don't want.
In the interest of full disclosure, do you receive any private insurance money?
I'm a government official. No campaign contributions. You can't do that.
In other words, it's the environment. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Zeke Emanuel about his vision for a complete overhaul of our healthcare system. Let's go to another audience question. Your plan could set up a two-tiered system. Those who can afford it will have a gold standard, and those who can't will be without. How do you prevent this?
I'm sure you want to prevent the without. Let me just say, I think tiering, or the rich being able to buy more, first of all, let's recognize it's inherent, right? In Canada, they have one system, everyone. The rich still buy more. They come to the United States. They go to Harley Street in Britain. From a practical standpoint, the rich will always buy more and buy out. If they don't buy it here, they'll buy it in the Cayman Islands. They'll go to Britain. They'll go to Switzerland, wherever it's being offered. So from a practical standpoint, you will have a two-tier system. Let's be realistic. Second of all, the question shouldn't be, can the rich buy more? The real question we want to ask is, for the vast majority of people who aren't rich, what are we giving them? And is what we're giving them good? And that seems to me to be the question we want. How they spend their money, that's their business. What we want to know is, if we're in the system, do we get good services that are proven effective? And that, it seems to me, is the key question. You know, I have a brother who's a Hollywood agent, and he has way too much money for his own good. He is Mr. Hypochondriac. right? Something happens, he wants the MRI scan, he wants this, he wants that. I don't want to deny him that. If that's how he wants to waste his money, God bless that he has the money to waste. What I want to know is, when I get sick, do I have good enough care? That's a very different question. We should not be envious of them who want to get another MRI scan or too many of these things. We should want to know, is the care we're getting good value for money? And it seems to me that's the key question. And the structure I've outlined for the vast majority of Americans who aren't rich is going to be very good care and very good services.
What is the government's role, both federal and state, if any, in your proposed framework for guaranteed health coverage?
Oh, well, there's extensive role for government. For one thing, you need oversight. You need funding. You need someone to organize the insurance exchanges, to collect data and process the data and analyze the data, to oversee the various health plans and make sure they're actually doing what they claim to be doing. There's still a whole panoply of things. I mean, we do need lots of government oversight. This isn't a dysregulated, unregulated market. That would be terrible. You just can't have that. This is way too complicated.
How do you propose lowering insurance companies' overhead in your plan?
Again, I think this is another case, it seems to me, of where we're aiming at the wrong target. I don't like fancy suites. I don't like million-plus dollar bonuses, etc. But it seems to me, what do we want to focus on? We want to focus on, we're going to pay you and we're going to assess your quality of care. How they achieve that, that's going to take experimentation. That's going to take a lot of different kinds of initiative. And I'm less worried about that. As a matter of fact, if we pay them and demand high-quality care, I don't think that those perks, there's going to be a lot of money left over for that. So it seems to me what we've got to do is focus on what we want out of the system instead of trying to find evil people everywhere and say, that's the problem. Chief executives of pharmaceutical companies, too rich. Chief executives of an insurance company, too rich. Chief executives of hospitals, too much money. Cardiothoracic. There are more than enough evil people in that arrangement. It seems to me we want to focus more on how to create a structure where people are trying to provide the right health care and get good outcomes at a fair and reasonable price to all Americans. And when we try to find the evil devil here, we're really missing the bigger problem with the system, which is the way we've structured it. And I think if I can send any message to someone here tonight, that is the issue. You can find and get rid of all of the rich corporate executives at the insurance companies, and you will not fundamentally get universal coverage in this country, have reasonable cost control, and improve substantially the quality of care in America. You just won't. And so that is barking up the wrong tree.
What is your definition of basic health care, and why should people need to pay more for more services?
So I think this is a fantastic question. Let me tell you where I begin. I begin, and I think most people who've looked at the problem begin with the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan. That's the plan that federal employees get, that senators and congressmen get. It's not the richest package in America, but it's pretty good. It's very good. And that is, if it's, as people like to say, if it's good enough for congressmen, whatever it is, it's probably good enough for most Americans. And I think that's where we should begin the debate. And we can discuss whether we should dial it down or there are some things that we might want to include. It includes hospital care, primary care, prevention, referrals, mental health benefits. It's a fairly rich package, and I think most of us would be very happy with it. I know most of us. It's better than what 85% of Americans have. That's the kind of package I have in mind.
Number of questions about bioethics. Here's an intriguing one. I work in a large hospital's ICU. When you talk about barriers to reform, what about the patients and families wanting, quote-unquote, everything done for their loved one, when the best medical advice agrees that efforts are futile?
It It's a fantastic question, and typically, but not always, that is a result of a failure of communication through the system. But let us get to, I think, the underlying point of that question, which is when we demand services. Now, it's easy to point to some family in the ICU and say they're demanding millions of dollars being paid. You wouldn't have a healthcare crisis if it were one or two families. We wouldn't have these costs out of control. It's always too easy to point to someone else. Let us ask ourselves, and I just got a question about, can't we have a really rich benefits package to cover everything we want? Sort of goes in the opposite direction. Part of what we need to do, it seems to me, is to have a situation where what's called value-based insurance, where things which are proven effective, proven to improve health, you don't have to pay a copay. Things which are discretionary, that extra MRI test, that extra chemotherapy, where there's no evidence it's really going to work, you might have to pay more for, maybe even a lot more. Let me give you one of my favorite examples. As you heard, I'm an oncologist. I happen to be a breast oncologist, so I'll pick on the prostate cancer doctors. This year, there will be more than 200,000 American men diagnosed with prostate cancer, most of them early-stage prostate cancer. And there's a lot of different ways we can treat that. One way is watchful waiting. For many men, it will not be a threat, and they will die with the disease and not of the disease. Another way is surgery, remove the prostate, prostatectomy. A third way is radiation therapy. And inside of radiation therapy, there are at least four different flavors of radiation therapy you can have. There's 3D conformal radiation, the traditional style that you use an MRI to focus the beam, costs about $11,000. There's brachytherapy, where you take little radiation seeds and actually implant it in the prostate, costs about $15,000, $16,000. Then there's IMRT, intensity modulated radiation therapy, focus the beam even more, $42,000. And then some of you know there's proton beam therapy. You don't even send in electrons, you send in protons, positively charged ions. The machines cost $100, $200 million, have to be housed in a football-sized building. That costs $80,000. So you might ask yourself, what's the difference? Well, I can tell you, for early-stage prostate cancer, zero difference in terms of survival. I also can tell you, we really don't know very much about the comparison because there's never been a head-to-head study of these four different treatments. At best, we think, from single-institution studies, my experience, that there might be a decline in side effects from about 14% of men having side effects in the 3D conformal radiation to 4% or 5% in the proton beam. So you might ask yourself, is that worth $70,000? For the ladies in the audience, look at the man next to you and ask, would you pay $70,000? So that's a case where you might say, a good insurance system would say, look, we'll pay $11,000 or $15,000 for the basic radiation. You want proton beam? God bless. You pay the remaining $55,000, $65,000. So that's a situation where we provide everyone very good care in this country. You want the deluxe model? You can pay for the deluxe model. Now, that goes to the tiering system. Is that tiering? You bet it's tiering. Is it bad tiering? I don't think so. We all get very good care. Let me give you another story, if I might, here. I had to get a crown in my mouth because I'm not so careful. And the dentist recommended this titanium whatever, right? And the insurance company sent back to me and said, we only cover gold, and if you want the titanium, it's $500 more. And I was outraged. But then I sat back and said, that's very reasonable. If gold is good care, but I want the super deluxe titanium, I should pay that extra $500. And it seems to me that is very fair. It makes me think, how much is that worth it to me? And that's what we have to get more of, not just, right, in them, but in us too. We have to experience that and make those choices for ourselves. We should stop pointing fingers at everyone else. And that, may I suggest to you, requires restructuring the healthcare market. Most of us don't see that now. We need to restructure the system so we're paying for value, and if we want more value, if we want the deluxe, we pay that difference rather than asking our neighbor to pay it for us.
Reminder that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Zeke Emanuel about his vision for a complete overhaul of our healthcare system. And our audience here tonight obviously includes a number of Kaiser patients, because this question has been asked a number of ways. What do you think of Kaiser's model of healthcare?
Look, Kaiser is a classic model of integrated care under one system where they have an incentive to have the doctors work with the hospitals, work with the other types of healthcare providers. I think it's a very good model of care, and most people that have studied it think that it's provided excellent care comparable to anything in the country. And here I should have a confession to make. Some of the senior executives at Kaiser are good friends of mine. So they haven't bought me any dinners, but I do think it's a wonderful model, and I think, you know, is it good for everyone? Will everyone want it? Probably not. Are there lots of people who have experienced it and really like it? The answer is yes.
Our elected officials right now are struggling mightily to find ways to increase unemployment, increase employment, which this economy needs. Freudian slip. Healthcare reform will inevitably reduce employment. How do you reconcile these two effects?
Oh, dear me, that is very limited. I don't agree with that premise at all. So the first thing to say is that no one is talking about taking money out of the healthcare system. No one. For one thing, if you want to cover 47 million Americans, you're at least going to have to keep the system as it is, if not expand it a little bit initially. What we want to do is change the rate of growth from year to year. So from an employment standpoint, you're not going to get rid of a total number of people. Now, you might have people doing different things. You might not have people doing insurance billing, and you might have some people instead looking at quality of outcomes or providing more services. So the job descriptions might be different, but I think the total employment is not going to decline at all. Second, if we can actually get costs under control, if we can actually restrain increases from year to year in medicine, what's going to happen? More of your money is going to stay in your pocket. State's going to have more money which to invest. We're actually going to have better economic times. So let me just give you some history. Between 1993 and 1998, roughly, 1999, healthcare inflation actually moderated in this country, stayed relatively flat. That turned out to be the time of managed care, which most Americans hated. But one of its very important side effects was relatively low healthcare inflation. Well, what was the economy doing, though, during those years? Was employment rising? Quite the contrary. Some of the best economic years America's had since the 1960s. Those were the Clinton boom years. Now, there are many things that contributed to that time, but all the economists agree that one of the key things was a moderation of healthcare inflation that allowed an increase in wages and allowed people to spend their money more, that stimulated the economy. So I do not accept the premise that if we have healthcare reform, we're going to decrease employment and create more economic problems. Quite the contrary. Moderating healthcare inflation, getting everyone into the healthcare system, will have, I think, just the opposite effect. It'll actually be good in the long term, even in the short term, for the American economy.
How does your plan deal with the lack of primary care doctors in this country?
That is a fantastic question. We have a serious problem. Ask yourselves again, why do we have a serious problem? Is that because doctors are nasty people and they don't like to talk to patients? Or is it, again, a structural problem? We pay people to do things, procedures, put in that stent, do that operation. Well, you don't have to be an economic genius, Nobel Prize winner, to figure out, well, if I do a lot of those, if I go into a specialty that does a lot of those procedures, I can actually make a lot of money. On the other hand, if I talk to patients and that doesn't get paid, it's going to be really hard to pay the bills, even if much as I like it. So you have to have a major change in how we pay doctors. And we have to compensate more for talking to patients, managing their problems, rather than doing things to them, whether it's tests or another treatment. So that's the key question. And my system, you've got the insurance companies, are going to be required to report outcomes. They're going to be within a fixed budget. They're going to have a real incentive to change who gets paid a lot of money. Not to use more tests, but to actually have more communication, more caring. And so that, I think, is a fundamental issue. There are other things that we would need to do. I think we need to change medical education that encourages people who are interested in primary care going in. We need to decrease the debt of doctors. So there are lots of things that we could do, but I think the fundamental thing we have to do is change what we pay for and how we pay.
Why do you say that Medicare and Medicaid need to be phased out? Is this really necessary?
Well, they are very, well, let's take Medicare. It's a very good program. People are very satisfied with it, but it is unsustainable from a fiscal standpoint. And I believe there are good reasons to phase it out and to try to put everyone in one program. Would I go to the mat for this? If we had health care reform and we were keeping Medicare, actually, that would be okay with me. But let me say one problem here. Why should we segregate out the 65-year-olds? Just think of the incentive structure that creates for insurance companies or everyone else. You don't do a great job, someone turns 65, there's someone else's financial problem. One of the things you want to do is to have people responsible fiscally for their issues if they're not taking good care of people. And so that's one of the reasons. The Medicaid side, it's just, I think, for some people, it does a great job, but overall, it doesn't pay enough. 50% of doctors don't take Medicaid patients. They have a very difficult time getting primary care. I think it's widely perceived to be a second-class program. You want to fold them into the system where they're with everyone else rather than segregate them out. Plus, there's a huge turnover there that makes it very difficult to give good quality continuity of care. The average time, I think, in New York on Medicaid is 9 months. It's very hard to take care of people when they're in and out of the system. So,
unfortunately, we're now at the point where we have time for one more question, so I'll ask you an easy one, Zeke Emanuel. So where is the patient responsibility in all this?
I think that is a tremendously good question because about 35, 40, 50% of health is related to what we eat, our exercise, and smoking. Those three things, we control a lot of our healthcare destiny. Not everything, but a big portion of it. Now, we don't control that alone. As you know, fast food didn't just grow up and we go to McDonald's. It's the whole social infrastructure related to that, whole social network related to smoking. So it requires concerted action, but we do have to take our responsibility. Let's flip it around. How might that happen under a new system or the system I describe? Again, think through what happens if you're an insurance company and you're now got the same people year after year after year. Suddenly you begin to think, you know, if I get too many kids who are obese, this is really going to be dangerous for me. Let's think how we might counter that. Well, I could have the pediatricians change, or I could think through maybe we could go to the schools or to parents and really change the way they're dealing with kids. We could change the incentive structure. You know, a lot of schools got budget cuts. What do? Get rid of gym, get rid of after-school activities. Very bad situation. So we have to empower the healthcare system to think innovatively about how to help us be healthier too. And I hope that, I mean, part of what the thinking that's gone into our program, our plan, is to try to do that or to create the incentive structure again that'll make that possible. Thank you very much.
Please. Please join me in thanking Zeke Emanuel, Chair of the Department of Bioethics at the Clinical Center of the National Institutes of Health and author of Healthcare Guaranteed. Also want to thank our audience here, especially for all your terrific questions. I wish I could have gotten to more. And on the radio, this program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.